Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolfe. Like crocuses, spring foods seem like promises of warmth and sunshine. Asparagus, artichokes, green garlic, strawberries. We'll celebrate the bounty of spring and then look ahead to the summer garden. And we'll look at how to get it all fresh and local. So, let's dig in. Susan Russo is a food writer in San Diego. She publishes stories, recipes, and photos on her cooking blog, Food Blogger. She also mills around local farmers markets. In early spring, she's there looking for strawberries. She wrote about what to do with them for NPR's Kitchen Window Online. She joins me today from San Diego. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Bonnie.
So the strawberries look pretty good in California.
The strawberries are looking beautiful in California.
We have California strawberries in the Northeast also.
Right, I'm sure. Well, actually, that's because most of the country gets California strawberries most of the year. Apparently, we produce close to 90% of the strawberries that are eaten throughout the country.
Is that right?
Yeah. Apparently, California produces over 1 billion pounds of strawberries a year, if you can believe that.
Are they all the same kind of strawberry?
No, they aren't. Actually, there are several different varieties. I think a couple of the most popular ones are called Camarosa and Avalon. And those are grown in Oxnard, California. That's where most of the strawberries are grown here and then just shipped throughout the country year-round.
Why is California such a good place to grow strawberries?
Well, I think it's because we have a mild climate. It never gets really hot or really cold because I think strawberries like to have cool weather. If it gets too hot and humid, it sort of melts the flesh of the strawberries. So the farmers have told me that's one of the reasons that they do so well here. They get the kind of cool ocean air and lots of sunlight without the heat and humidity that could damage the berries.
What's the strawberry season in California?
Actually, our best strawberries are probably January to March. And we have them all year long, actually. You can get them 12 months of the year. But in the heat of the summer, probably August, September is when we have the least strawberries because it's just too warm at that point. So it's kind of ironic that we have the best strawberries when the rest of the country doesn't. And when everybody else gets their fresh-picked strawberries, it's usually when ours are not the best anymore.
Now, you get California strawberries all over the country. Why do they taste so bad from the supermarket when they're out of season?
Oh, that's such a great question. And I can tell you why. I actually spoke to a farmer. His name is Ted Thacker, and he runs Thackerberry Farms, which is a pretty popular strawberry farm here in Southern California, and they have local stands where they sell their wonderful strawberries. And what he told me basically is that there are two kinds of strawberries. You have strawberries that are grown for production, and what that means is those strawberries are grown in California. They're picked when they're about half ripe, and then they're gassed, which means that they're treated with a carbon dioxide solution. And they do this to prevent spoilage, so that way those strawberries can remain fresh on that 4 to 5 day truck journey to wherever it is that they're going. So people who live in South Dakota, say in February, can go to their local supermarket and buy strawberries, but they aren't going to taste good, like you said. That's because they weren't allowed to vine ripen. That's the second type of strawberry. The vine ripened strawberry means that it's allowed to ripen fully, so that the sugars really have a chance to produce. And the shelf life, in contrast, is only about a day. They're highly perishable because they're so super sweet and succulent. So that's why those berries that you get in the middle of the winter, they may look pretty, but they don't really taste that great.
In your piece for Kitchen Window Online, you talk about the early uses of strawberries in the U.S. and mm-hmm. that they were not as sweet. Is that right?
Yeah. They said that when the European colonists came here to North America, that the native Indians were eating strawberries, but they were wild strawberries. And apparently they were much smaller and not as sweet. And what the Indians would do is they would take those strawberries and they would mix them with a cornmeal into kind of a mush and then bake it almost into a bread. And then once the colonists tasted the bread that the Indians had made, they liked it so much that they revised the recipe and made their own creation using a European shortcake recipe. And that was actually how the American strawberry shortcake was born.
That's wonderful. Then a sweeter strawberry was cultivated?
Right. In the 18th century, apparently they crossbred two different types of strawberries and created what is known today as the modern-day strawberry, which is a much larger, redder, and sweeter strawberry.
Now, I had always heard that the bigger the strawberry, the less tasty they are. Is there any truth to that?
You know, I've heard the same thing, and I'm so glad you asked me that, because I can tell you from lots of strawberry eating experience that that is not true. And I've actually asked a lot of farmers that, too, and they said, not really, not anymore. Because of advances in technology where they've been able to crossbreed strawberries so many times that they can pretty much determine how sweet that strawberry is going to be, it really doesn't matter that size and sweetness do not necessarily correlate. I've been told that what is more important is actually that it's vine-ripened, and that when you look at the strawberry, the top of the strawberry, just before you get to the green hull, they call that the shoulders of the strawberry, to make sure that that is red and not white. That means that it's got more sugar crystals inside the strawberry and that it'll be sweeter.
Oh, that's a very good tip.
Yeah.
We most often think of strawberries in desserts, but
right,
they're also used in savory foods.
Yes. Strawberries are wonderful in savory dishes, particularly in meat dishes. If you use strawberries in salsas, you can pair them with other sweet fruits. You can pair them with mangoes and then put it with onions or a little bit of vinegar so that you have that kind of sweet contrasting with the sourness, like as you would with a typical chutney. And that sweet and sourness really goes well when you pair it with buttery pork, for example, or a nice piece of grilled chicken. And strawberries also go really well with salads. And I like them with particularly spicy salad greens, like arugula or endive, so that you get that contrast between the sweetness and the pepperiness of the arugula.
Mm. In your piece, you say that you can freeze strawberries, something I had no idea that you could do. Tell me about that.
Yeah, actually, it's really easy. What to do is you just buy your strawberries, remove the hull, rinse them lightly and pat them dry, and then just place them on a single layer on a cookie sheet so that they're not touching, and freeze them. And then once they're frozen, you just take them out, place them inside of Ziploc bags, and keep them in your freezer, and you can use them year-round. Just remember, though, that they'll be much softer when they're defrosted, so they're really good for sauces or jams or smoothies.
So do you have strawberries at home right now?
Yes.
And what are you going to have for dinner tonight?
Actually, I am going to have a strawberry salad tonight. I have some fresh arugula and strawberries, and maybe I'll put a little bit of goat cheese and some candied pecans on it.
All right. I'll be right over. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you, Bonnie. This was fun.
That was food writer Susan Russo. California food writer Peggy Knickerbocker has some ideas for spring cooking. She shares them with NPR's Linda Wertheimer.
Now, even though we now have everything all the time in our big supermarkets, things like asparagus and artichokes, it seems to me they really do taste better in season. So we wait for them all winter, and then we throw them into boring boiling water. I wonder if you could suggest something else to do. Let's start with artichokes.
Well, if you have a great big one, take off the thorny tops. Just chop them off. Cut them in half lengthwise. Scoop out the choke. And then you can just sort of stew them in some water and white wine or maybe a little chicken stock. Or you can slice them up. And then you have this wonderful soft stewed thing that is, with these particles of artichoke that you can scoop over a little bit of fish or toss into a pasta. And then just this last weekend, I had this wonderful thing at a restaurant called Boulette's Larder in San Francisco, which is the Roman-style artichokes in Rome. I think they're called charcofi a la Judea, excuse mm-hmm. my accent. But with them, you sort of squish them down and twist them. They have to be very, very fresh. And then you deep fry them in olive oil.
Wow.
And then you get this wonderful sort of caramelized camel color crisp flour that you just sort of pick the leaves off and you can crunch the whole thing into your mouth. And
huh.
They're absolutely delicious.
Asparagus is another one of those things that you can just you can boil it up. Or what else can you do?
What you do is you just snap the asparagus off where they give, you know, so that they're sort of
so
trimmed
you only
up.
Have the tender part.
You only have the tender part, but a good part of the stem. And then you put them on a baking sheet, drizzle with olive oil, season with salt and pepper, and roast for about 10 minutes at 400 degrees. Then while they're roasting, you fry up a couple of eggs, depending upon how many people you're serving, and toast a little French bread. And then when they're all done, you scoop out the asparagus and put about 3 on each piece of toast. Put a fried egg on top of the asparagus, grate a little Parmesan over the top, and then you serve that for a nice little lunch or first course for dinner. And then when you break the yolk sort of creates a sauce with the olive oil and it oozes into the toast, and it's just a wonderful spring meal.
Well, let's move quickly on to dessert. Strawberries, which California has almost all the time. We don't really get the good stuff until late May. But if we were to follow up our spring veggies with a little fruit dessert?
Well, one dessert I love is to slice strawberries after you've taken the little green cap off and just toss them with a bit of marmalade. Just makes such a good little sauce for them.
You mean just like orange marmalade out of a jar?
Yeah, just a couple of tablespoons. Just sort of toss it in. It's just delicious.
Strawberries and cream. I think you can't beat that.
When we were growing up, we used to have strawberries, and then on the side, we'd have a little bowl of sour cream and a little bowl of brown sugar, and then you'd double dip. And that was a pretty good combination, too.
Peggy Knickerbocker is speaking to us from KQED. Peggy, thank you so much.
Oh, I love being with you.
That was NPR's Linda Wertheimer. When spring turns into summer, there will be the quest not only for wonderful strawberries, but for the sweetest corn, the juiciest watermelon, and the best peach. Too often, the fruits from the supermarket are not what we're looking for. The watermelon is, well, watery. The strawberries are big and beautiful, but tasteless. And peaches are mealy. Why? NPR's Joe Palca talks with Russ Parsons, the food and wine columnist for the Los Angeles Times and author of the book How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table.
Russ Parsons, how did we get here? So I want to start with my own little anecdote here. You know, I grew up in New York City and I didn't like vegetables. And then my parents took me when I was, I guess I was a teenager, to France, and I ate raw carrots and raw cruciferous vegetables. They must have been green peppers or something. Anyway, and I suddenly, these are great. These are fantastic. These taste wonderful. And so it was as if I'd never tasted them before. So was it just
right,
being dazzled by being in a foreign country? Or is there really a difference between the produce that Americans have gotten to accept and what happens elsewhere?
Well, I think there's a big difference, especially when we were kids. I think now more and more people are finding that kind of experience just by going to their neighborhood farmer's market, mm-hmm. or to, you know, even good produce departments in supermarkets are having much better luck. But, you know, when the way this whole thing started, it's the law of unintended consequences again, because what happened was that a system was built to make sure that everybody had plenty of good, inexpensive fruits and vegetables, which we do. I mean, malnutrition is no longer nearly the problem it was. Obesity is a problem now. And lack of flavor became a huge problem. And it's all built into the system, because the system, in the old days in the United States, every major city was surrounded by a farm belt. And that farm belt supplied the fruits and vegetables that the people in the city ate. Well, around the turn of the century, a couple things happened. Most of it was transportation related. You know, there was the railroad that crossed the United States. There was the opening up of California's Central Valley. There was the invention of the refrigerated rail car. You know, one of the great overlooked inventions of all time, because it allowed produce to be shipped from California back to New York. At the same time, local transportation in the urban areas was allowing people to get outside of the urban centers and to develop the suburbs. And suburbs you know, then as now, usually end up on farmland. So the farmers had to go someplace. California, the eastern slopes of Oregon and Washington turned out to be perfect places to grow fruits and vegetables. All of that kind of change, there are macro changes and there are micro changes. They required a new system of produce distribution to be put into place. And that system of produce distribution over the period of 50 years kind of resulted in everybody playing the cards as safely as they could and picking things earlier and earlier, choosing varieties that would ship better over varieties that tasted better, and we ended up with what was all too often pretty undistinguished fruits and vegetables. Hmm. What's happened now, though, and that I'm really excited about in the last 30 years. Is the impact that farmers' markets have had on the produce distribution. Because under the old system, there was no way for a farmer to get any kind of financial incentive for growing great fruits and vegetables. You know, if you grew peaches that made a grown man cry and your neighbor next to you pumped his orchards full of water and picked as much as he could, he got more money than you did because there wasn't kind of the flavor disincentive bonus.
Yeah, financial disincentive for coming up with a good tasting peach that you didn't have a lot of.
Right, because all the decisions many of the decisions that lead into good tasting peaches mean smaller yields.
Yeah,
and so with farmers markets, that kind of turned that all the way around because a farmer could say, "Taste this. Now, do you think that that's worth more than a supermarket peach?"
Yeah.
The thing that's really happened since then, though, is that ethos has kind of created a second commodity stream for produce, where there are specialty produce distributors all over the country now who are selecting local or high quality things, and putting them in restaurants and supermarkets,
and charging a premium for them, I presume.
I would hope so.
Yeah. We're talking with Russ Parsons about his book, How to Pick a Peach, and we'd certainly like to hear about you and your fruit experiences or produce of any description. We're very open-minded here today. I mean, I guess the question is, and you refer to it in the book, in a way, we consumers were complicit with this because we said, yeah, okay, we'll buy strawberries year-round even though they don't grow year-round. And so we wound up having to take stuff that was produced with the intention of having it stick around for a long time.
Well, I think a lot of times, you know, we want what we want, and we want it now. The original strawberry was a 6-week crop. In order to have strawberries year-round, I mean, California produces strawberries 11 months out of the year now. In order to produce that, because, I mean, you know, people in New York hotels want to have sliced strawberries in January when they're eating their breakfast. There was a market there, and so agriculture evolved to supply that market.
All right. Right. Let me ask you another question. I mean, in terms, let's focus on the peach for a minute. Now, you hinted that growing techniques affect the way the peach is produced, and I was just working with a producer who said she had a job in Israel where they were making peaches of rubbing the peach plant so that it would what's the word I'm looking for?
Pollinate?
Pollinate, yes, more effectively, and she still has the blisters from it, she said. But the idea was to reduce the yield so you'd only get the very best peaches. Can you take the same fruit and ruin it, or is it different varieties that are chosen for specific qualities?
No, you know, in fact, that's one of the things I think people are still a little naive about, because you have to remember that produce, fruits and vegetables, they're grown, they're not manufactured. And so when you're buying a variety, you know, if you're buying a great Alberta peach, it's not the same thing as buying a Lincoln. You know, a good farmer can take a mediocre variety and grow good fruit.
Mm-hmm.
A bad farmer can take a great variety and grow mediocre fruit. So what you need to look for is, first of all, you need to follow the farmer, and then you need to hope that farmer picks a great variety. Because when you get those two things in sequence, that's when you get that kind of, you know, that peach that makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck. And it's an expensive proposition because what they have to do, a lot of the steps that they have to take in order to get great fruits and vegetables are things that cost money, starting with really rigorous thinning. On the tree, so that there's, you know, they may lose half of the crop in the spring, so that the fruit that is left gets the concentration of the tree's vigor, for want of a better word,
right?
Then, you know, letting the fruit hang on the tree longer, so that it becomes more and more mature at the same time that it's beginning to ripen. At that stage, the fruit's becoming more tender, more fragile, and all kinds of things can happen to it. From, you know, I mean, the obvious disasters like a summer hailstorm to, you know, just like naughty birds. I mean, how many times have you know, if you've ever had a tree in your backyard, you know, you lose a certain percentage of your crop to the birds, and that happens in farms as well.
I don't think we should anthropomorphize here and describe birds as naughty, but never mind. Let's take a call now and go to Jennifer. And I take it, Jennifer, is that Norman, Oklahoma?
Yes.
Okay, Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you. This is a fascinating discussion for me because my husband is originally from the Middle East. And he considers himself to be a fruit connoisseur. he has actually been approached in the grocery store, and people ask him, how do you choose your fruit? Because it's very clear to people that he's very serious.
He's
about
discerning.
How he selects his fruit. Mm-hmm. You know, in his country, when we've been there, we've been blown away by the quality of the fruits and vegetables we've had there. Although in recent years, I would say that some kind of genetic engineering or whatever has actually crept into that country, and suddenly we're getting tomatoes the size of our heads and things that we never used to see before. But my husband's rule of thumb that he always tells people is that if you cannot smell the fruit, it's probably not worth buying. So if you put your nose up to it and there's no apple smell or orange smell wafting out of it, then it's probably not worth buying. And actually, the fruits he likes to buy the best are the ones that you can actually smell from about 15 feet away.
Jennifer, thanks for that call. What about that? Is the nose reliable?
The nose is 9 times out of 10. Probably 9 times out of 10. That's one of the great, great indicators. There are two basic things. One of them is the perfume. Because remember, fruits exist to carry seeds. And the farther from the tree the seed is carried, you know, so fruit, the fruit that surrounds the seed is delicious, so that it will be eaten and the seed will be carried far away. And one of the ways that attracts is through the perfume. Another really great tip, and I think that people don't focus on enough, is, you know, pick the stuff up. If fruit that's heavier for its size is always going to be better, because one of the things that happens after fruit's picked is it starts giving up moisture. And as it gives up moisture, the fruit becomes lighter and lighter. Now, there are some things that don't where smelling doesn't work. You know, for example, with melons, if you've got a netted melon, like a cantaloupe or a muskmelon, I mean, those things, when they are ripe, the perfume is just like it'll knock you over from 10 feet away. But a honeydew melon, there's no smell whatsoever.
Yeah.
And what's funny is that the Latin name for the family of the honeydew melon is inodorous. Specifically because there is no smell.
Well, how do you do a honeydew when there's no smell?
That sounds like a song, doesn't it? Yeah. How do you do a honeydew? Maybe
from
the 20s or something.
Honey,
like that.
Let's do the honeydew.
Yeah, do the honeydew.
Okay.
So honeydews are tough. There's a couple things that you can look for with a honeydew. One of them is the quality of the color. Instead of being kind of a hard, bright color, the color should be rich and creamy. Another thing is touch. When you feel the rind of a honeydew, it should be, I don't know how to describe that actually. It's kind of velour instead of like marble. There's a slight rub to it instead of being hard and slick. The third thing that you can check with the honeydew is every melon, when it's grown, there's a little pale spot on one side of the melon. The French call it the couche, and that's where the melon rested when it was on the ground. Check the color of that, because if it's bright white, that the melon's underripe. It should be getting creamy, going to golden. Those are the best ways. The absolute, you know, the honeydew melon that's going to completely knock you over all summer, if you find them that have where the surface is sticky, or if you find them where there are little brown speckles on the surface, those are going to be amazing, because the honeydew is, when it gets really ripe and it's really sweet, the sugar starts to bleed through the rind. Now, the complication is that produce managers usually think that that's a flaw, and so they'll wash it all off.
There you go.
But if you can, if that's there, man, you got a great melon.
All right. So, you know, your book talks about the fact that most of the fruit in America is grown in California. I mean, what does that do?
More than half.
More than half. What does that do to people on the East Coast such as us? I mean, do we just have to yearn, or do we have to pay, you know, airfare for a plum or something like that? Or can we really hope to get good fruit over here?
No, you can get grapefruit over there. One of the problems on the East Coast is you have to recognize that it's more difficult to grow fruit on the East Coast, which is why it moved to the West Coast. On the West Coast, our summers are really hot and they're really, really dry. On the East Coast, the summers may be really hot, but they're really humid. And that humidity encourages all kinds of problems. But you can get grapefruit if you just have to work a little harder for it. And by going to the farmer's market, by tasting, by shopping around. You need to really engage all of your senses. I mean, we're really lucky out here. I don't want to open up the door for any more California.
No.
But I also don't want to imply that everything that's grown commercially in California is bad. Because if you know what you're doing, you know, if the first step is just paying attention to what you're shopping for instead of picking things up as if they were tube socks, you know.
Well, I'm good at tube socks, but yeah, I'm not quite as good at fruit. Hey, Russ Parsons, we've run out of time. I'm sorry. Thanks very much for joining us today. Maybe if people can't pick peach, they can pick tube socks.
Well,
possible.
Thanks for having me on.
How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table.
That was NPR's Joe Palca. Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and lots of recipes. Join us next time when we sample some feta cheese. I'm Bonnie Wolfe.